Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trabucchi
and Thomas Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation. Welcome to another episode of Talking About Platforms. My name is Philip Meyer. With me, I have my regular co-host, Daniel Trabucchi. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Philip. Hi, everyone.
And we have today's guest, which is Professor Robin Kaplan, who is an assistant professor at Duke University, professor of technology policy, and the research affiliate at the Data and Society Research Institute. Hi, Robin.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the podcast is titled Talking About Platforms. So we tend to talk with people that talks about platforms, but the word platform is not as useful as it used to be, since it has so many different meanings, so many different perspectives, that our first question is always, what is a platform to you? And even to get a bit more personal and to start knowing you, how you end up studying platforms.
So what is a platform to me? I talk about this with my students a lot. And in almost every single talk I give, I kind of have to set up this question. And it's a really interesting question because the boundaries and contours of what a platform is and isn't has tended to shift over time. I like to use, I've worked with Charlton Gillespie a lot of the years, and I tend to use his definitions on these things because he is the cool uncle of the field, we can say. And he's really shifted his own definitions of this. He has a tendency to look at it in terms of the features that platforms have. Their data infrastructures, and they provide like the infrastructure for collecting more data. They primarily host user-generated content. They moderate content. But the truth is that, what we think of as a platform really tends to shift. It tends to shift according to, what the platform itself is doing. So YouTube, for instance, had a long period there where they were hosting user-generated content, but they were also producing their own content. And then that can shift the other types of sites and companies that we think of as platforms. So one of the big questions that I give to my students these days is Netflix a platform? That used to be what we thought of as the quintessential platform in the past. But because it only really hosts content from established media organizations, and we're starting to kind of do that conceptual work to reinsert a lot of these companies back into their domains, that seems like a more clear example of this is very clearly a media company. Most of my students at this point would no longer consider Netflix a platform because it kind of lacks that user generated. So the boundaries of what we kind of consider a platform and not are really still continuing to shift and change. How did I get into this work? That's a long story. It's a long and messy story, actually. So I was doing undergraduate work at University of Toronto in psychology. At the time, neuropsych was the framework that most people were thinking of, but cognitive science was beginning to kind of become a much more dominant area of study. I fell into a group of students that were really interested in cognitive science and AI. And then I started continuing that path forward. So I had kind of meant to go forward and continue work in psychology. I ended up doing a master's in media, culture, and communication because I wanted to understand more of the culture of how thought comes to be. But I had that good foundational theoretical work within cognitive science. And so I think that was always really grounding me to think about these questions and think in terms of these frameworks. So I eventually found my way back into information science, and then it's been a combination of my own interests and world events that have kind of propelled me in particular directions. That's a short and long answer.
That's super interesting. And you know, I always have to smile because Netflix is an example that is brought up pretty regularly when, like in the, let's say, a borderline platform, right? So was the labeled as platform for a long time, then it is not anymore. While I would say Netflix has some characteristics at least, right? So they bring in like user generated, let's say, data when it comes to ranking, the ranking algorithm. They're looking into gaming, so maybe they move toward more towards platforms again and again. But I think Daniel, looking in your direction, when I reviewed your book, I think this was something that I highlighted because you labeled it back then when you were writing it as a platform.
Let's say that Tommaso and myself have an evolving opinion on what platform is the current situation. So. In the moment of the recording, let's say, our position is Netflix is not a platform, but is a company applying a platform strategy for the way in which they actually use the data. Because we have this idea of orthogonal platforms that are gathering data from a lot of users and aggregating them. They offer value to another kind of customer that in this case is the movie production department within Netflix, but still there is a mechanism based on externalities. So we see the strategy, but definitely Netflix itself, it's not a platform. And then I think we can also say, you know, among the three of us and the listeners, that saying Netflix is not a platform is such a cool statement and actually as a plus in the statement itself.
That's true. Robin, I would like to start talking about platform governance with you and your perspective on the topic. I think for me, at least, when I look at platforms, one of the very, very interesting characteristics is that they combine basically some characteristics of, let's say, an organization, a firm, and some of a market. And then the governance, in my opinion, and your definition, of course, is of high interest to me. The governance is a lot about the, let's say, rules of the game, right? Under what rules are services, goods, information exchange between different actors on this market that is partially controlled, partially not. Please tell me what's your take on platform governance? What fascinates you, and what's maybe your perspective on the topic?
My perspective on the topic. Platform governance. So I find this term governance to be really interesting and compelling. And I found it really interesting and compelling when we were talking in terms of media governance as well, not platform governance, and just the ways that we can kind of turn our attention away from just the kind of control of the state and how rules are made towards a variety of different ways that behavior is kind of impacted by other sorts of rules. And those rules can include markets. So that's like an interesting component of it. Markets can also serve as governance mechanisms, and culture can as well. So when I think about platform governance, there was like a way of looking at it in the past where it said, okay, platform governance is governance of and by platforms. So in that sense, we're looking at regulation of platforms. So we're looking at government as a regulating force. We are looking at also how platforms govern their users. So what are the kind of standards? What are the privacy policies? What are the terms of service? The kind of controls and constrains or facilitates how users interact with the site. And that can include, you know, UX components as well. And then I also like to add governance through platforms. So what are the ways that platforms themselves kind of facilitate governance between users. So thinking in terms of the structure of Reddit, this kind of central, kind of more federal system where you have these base rules, then you have these subreddits that have their own additional rules. How are platforms kind of facilitating the governance of users kind of collectively or how they kind of govern each other. That's how I tend to view platform governance. What I find so interesting and compelling about it is that it is kind of so complex and it's happening at so many different levels simultaneously. And you're also really dealing, you're dealing, like, I think in most governance situations, you're dealing with networked actors where there's like, when something happens over here, people over here are impacted. With platforms, what makes it really interesting is that you can often see a lot of these networked actors on display. So you can see when there's a change over here, this group over here might benefit, but this one over here does not. And that really informs a lot of my work. So I tend to kind of try and look at these three levels in a variety of ways. Governing of platforms, just because I'm located within the US and I keep an eye towards regulations that are coming down the pipeline as much as I can. But the situation here is much messier. But I do have a tendency to look at like each of these stakeholder groups independently and how they're kind of interacting. So I've done work on platforms and how they create rules. What are the organizational dynamics that might impact how a rule is created and how it's applied between a small company and a large company? I look at who tries to influence this process. So I've looked at, you know, how a media association has come together and tried to influence how standards are set at platforms. And then I also like to look at who's impacted by this as well. So I've looked at it in the context of creators who sometimes have less of an influence into how rules are made, but they're often very affected by the outcome.
That's very interesting. I think you're touching a very relevant and critical aspect of platforms. I was wondering, you explained very clearly what are the various layers you are taking in your research. I was wondering if you'd like to share with us, going for highlights, what are your main findings that can be interesting for both the scholars, but also the practitioners listening to us, the main takeaways you've got with your research?
So I think from like a higher level, the main takeaway that underlies a lot of my research is that when we're talking about platform governance, we're often just talking about trade-offs, that there's never really any kind of clear winner or loser, that since everybody is networked together, it can often look like that. But what's happening behind the scenes is that you have people who are kind of trading off between two not equally good or bad outcomes, but they're just trying to kind of balance these two extremes. So for some of my work, the way that looks is looking at, in the context of content moderation, you know, how do we balance the trade-off between wanting to have rules that are contextual to cultures and linguistic diversity, while also like having a constancy, a consistency, a feeling that things are fair. Often what ends up happening, and another kind of finding of my work, is that when we're doing these trade-offs, when we're considering how these trade-offs are made, most of these trade-offs are made, you know, with an eye towards kind of philosophy and values. And that was like a big strain of work that was done in this area. I don't know if it's still pretty common now, but like looking specifically at things like values and design. But often what's like really controlling these, how these trade-offs get made and how these decisions get made are resource constraints. And whether those are resources that are like actually scarce or they are kind of inauthentically made scarce by platforms wanting to operate at the lowest cost as possible. But that's often what's kind of impacting how one of these trade-offs are made. What ends up happening because of that is that you start to see kind of a lot of the same nefarious issues that impact most of politics kind of showing up on platforms as well. So, you know, proximity to a decision maker can kind of impact how your content is treated, the amount of power you have within a network, the financial relationship that you have with platforms. All of that can have a really big impact on how you're treated online or how your content is treated online. So I think my work is always like trying to not only see newness in how these issues are presenting themselves, but kind of look at these like older concepts like power and imbalance and just see where that's kind of showing up online and how rules are made and enforced.
Yeah, talking about power, I think this is an extremely interesting concept. So I mainly look at business to business platforms, and they're mainly into business to business platforms defined as platforms where no like end consumers are present at all. Right, there are these hybrids, and I define them as this is no hybrid, there's only businesses. And in these platforms, it's typical that the fragmentation of the users is like relatively low, and the total number of addressable users is also relatively low. Now, you look into platforms, social media, where the fragmentation is very high, and the number of potential users is also very high. In my context, often the power that a platform can build in a setting where fragmentation among users across sites is low, numbers also low, the power is limited. Because in the end, often, on the one hand, it can be the case, and it's not so like uncommon, that users have the same, let's say, economic power on both sides than the platform itself. And that also, let's say, users can coordinate better because there are also few, they maybe know each other, they had ex ante business relationships with each other. So there is some kind of, I would say, a rather like something close to a market dynamic that moderates how much power a platform can generate industrial settings where these platforms emerge. While when I look at social media, to me, it's extremely interesting to look at recent developments, be it on X, former Twitter, be it on Reddit, where you see these interesting movements where people start shaping in some way or trying to influence governance mechanisms at these platforms. And do this through a coordinated act, right? So is this something that you see also like recently growing more into more like presence, or is this something that's just right now that I figured, or that the media maybe sees it as being more present? Because to me, it feels like there is some kind of rebalancing, although of course the power asymmetry is huge. But I see some first coordinated activities by users to hold these bigger social media and information platforms a bit more accountable. Is this something you share?
I do in a limited way. Like I okay. I am not like a... I'm strangely not a cynic when it comes to tech. And a lot of my research looks at how users have coordinated historically. So I don't see it as being a new phenomenon right now. I don't know whether or not what's happening right now is actually holding tech companies accountable and being successful at that, but I'll get into that a little bit later. So users, yes, you're right. So users are fragmented, but there have been lots and lots of cases that are pretty visible and that my research has looked at where we see a lot of coordination to kind of push back on platforms. The ways that my research has looked at this, I've looked at it through the lens of civil society organizations and how they are often engaged by platforms to give feedback. That's actually an instance where like there could be a lot more coordination that happens, but the platform itself kind of enables some of that fragmentation. So since they're talking to each of these groups individually, those groups don't really have a lot of capacity to organize, and they don't really know what's being said by the other side. There were a lot of cases really immediately after 2016 where news media organizations in specifically were coming together to do that sort of coordination. So I have one project I'm going to be presenting at AIR this week. I've never published it, so we'll see what happens with it. But that's following an organization called the Trust Project. And that was an international consortium of 200 publishers that were feeling like they were being too impacted by the decisions that were being made by Google and Facebook and how their content was categorized. And then so they wanted to kind of come together, figure out how could they figure out their own system for categorizing news content, make it machine readable, et cetera. There's still also a power imbalance there. I don't know how to deem the successfulness of something like that. I don't think it's really helpful to think about it in those terms. But the power imbalance that was happening there was that, you know, platforms were already framing the debate within their term. So when they went to these companies to be like, how can we not just be subject to the whims of your company and how you classify us, they were basically told, well, what you need to do is you take all your journalistic values and make them machine readable. And if you do that, then we will be able to prioritize in accordance with your values instead of ours. Well, if you're looking to make something like journalistic values machine readable, you're already kind of coming over to the logic of platforms. You're not really pushing back against that. So we still see kind of a power imbalance there. Users themselves have been kind of the most interesting area to study in this because to some extent, they have the least amount to lose in fighting back against platforms, especially creators, because they have built their entire life on these platforms. There's kind of no, if it doesn't exist on the platform, there's no real kind of business there. So you see some really interesting coordination amongst creators. So when it comes to, I did a project on YouTube and demonetization. Demonetization was something that was really spoken about quite widely on YouTube. It was spoken about by every single type of creator that was on the platform, whether you were a family blogger to a beauty vlogger to a political YouTuber, everybody was talking about it. And what they were trying to do when they were talking about it is that they were often trying to share strategies on how to push back. So they were either trying to share strategies on how the algorithm functioned, or they were sharing strategies on how to speak to YouTube representatives, how to kind of use their audiences to get angry at platforms to stop them from continually implementing policy changes that the creators had no knowledge of or couldn't control. You started to see a lot more coordination there. Again, limited power though. They really didn't have that much power to counteract the decisions that were being made by YouTube because YouTube had another set of stakeholders that they were also considering feedback from, namely advertisers, that was had a much bigger impact in how the decisions were being made. There's another interesting area where this is happening too. This is a new paper that I'm currently revising where I looked at with some co-authors, Alina Maris and Hibby Thetch, where we looked at mutual aid practices that are unfolding on TikTok. And that's a different way of thinking about how users are fighting back. So the phenomenon that we studied there looked at how kind of users in general are starting to understand the value that is available on platforms through things like creator funds or TikTok Live and GIFs. And they've been kind of using it and playing with it in ways where they're trying to redistribute that value according to their own, according to other kind of goals that maybe the platform doesn't have. And so you have users that are trying to play with the algorithm and come back to certain comments and interact with videos in ways that user might get some money from the creator fund to do things like escape a domestic violence situation or to get a home or to pay medical bills, et cetera. Other users are kind of coming together to fight back against what they see as cultural appropriation on TikTok to try and redistribute attention and therefore dollars to Black creators instead of white creators. So you're starting to see like very interesting ways of kind of pushing back against the logics that are being promoted and implemented by platforms. In terms of this current era of tech accountability, I don't know if that is what is happening. To be honest, I think that like what we are really seeing with platforms is like not a giving up, but they are pulling back in a variety of different ways because of other things that are happening, which is creating a little bit more room for pushback on these platforms themselves. But it's not, it's because of an absence of activity on the part of the platforms. I'm not certain why. Like, for instance, like Facebook is moving away from news. Twitter is moving away from, all of these platforms are moving away from news. Part of that is a response to like other forms of activism that had resulted in broad regulation. So in Canada has been passing the online news bill. Google and Facebook decided to pull news from them. Facebook and Google have been kind of presenting this narrative in relation to like news media within the context of the US, where they're saying they can't really win no matter what they do. They're getting like criticized. So they're also kind of pulling back from promoting news media there. So what's happening there is that it's kind of creating an absence. They're not really like doing much in this space that looks like a pushback, but I can't tell if it's an actual pushback or if they are, you know, circling the wagons. They all went through like a period of enormous change within the last year because they did massive layoffs. They're doing a lot of reorganizing. Like, it's very difficult to tell what's actually happening behind the scenes.
You know, moving from behind the scenes to your opinion in a certain way, you really got my attention when you said that basically it's a matter of balance between the various parties and the power of the various parties and the platform with the parties. I tend to study a different type of platforms, but I took once the perspective of the end users regarding their perception on how the platform is actually using their data. So in terms of, we call it business model transparency. And we found out that in a certain way, users are not still, at least, looking for it. But once they realize it, they can have it, they actually appreciate it. So understanding a bit more in a transparent and easy way what companies can actually do with their data. As a not as a user, but well, yeah, as a user, so on the other side, I've been following the adventures of content creators on Instagram, and I've seen many of them in various occasions complaining about the fact that from one day to another, without any evident reason, they stop appearing in the feed of some of their followers. They start appearing in others. And, you know, various situations like that due to changes in the algorithm. And what you were suggesting, what you were discussing, made me think about the chance to study business model transparency also on that side. So trying to understand what would be the effect, not really on the content creator, that would be pretty obvious, I guess, but on the platform. So why not actually managing the content creator as a proper customer as they are on the platform? What's your opinion about this? Have you ever come across any fault or any evidence on the platforms managing the algorithm towards content creator and these possible trade-offs you were discussing about?
Yeah, so I've never done any work on Instagram, so it's really hard for me to say. The only work I've done on Instagram is looking at the kind of competition between Reels and TikTok and YouTube Shorts. I'd say that in the context of YouTube, there has been an effort to kind of manage the creator as customer over the last, how long have they been? Almost two decades at this point, that they've been operating, or that since they've had a partner program, which started back in 2007. I think that was kind of like the first way that they were thinking about this, was that they were offering incentives basically to try and to certain creators, only there was only a few of them at first, to kind of entice them to make more content for the site. And the theory was that if we're nice to these creators, if we give them resources and they'll be able to make better content, then users will come to our site because there's better content available on the site and we'll all be better off. So there was this kind of sense that we will all be better off, which was fueling a lot of it. The program expanded continuously. It was offered in more countries. And then what you started to see was that, again, we had these resource constraints where the number of creators that were on the site, that were creating content on the site, far, far outmatched the resources that YouTube, for instance, was putting to bear on this. And so what they started doing then was they started kind of creating different classes of creators. What you have when you're starting to create different classes of creators is that you have like a certain class which you're kind of valuing more highly, which you're seeing as kind of a more valuable customer to kind of please than you are the lower creators. And that was done, you know, I would imagine just because of these resource constraints and where they were. So they were trying to basically manage where they were putting a lot of their money and their time and their energy. And a lot of this came down to money. There was like an agreement in terms of revenue sharing, but that was pretty stable across the different levels. But there was other things that were given. There was like a manager at YouTube. So you would have like a personal relationship with somebody at YouTube. You'd have access to spaces, you'd have access to equipment, et cetera. So and it almost served as kind of like a rewards program to get people to like work more and more and more and more, to get higher up in it. What has happened since then, at least within the context of YouTube, was that you had a lot of other types of organizations coming onto these sites. So it wasn't just creators. You had traditional media companies that were also coming online. And you also had kind of much bigger and broader systems that were being used to serve things like advertisements. From my own research, that was really the tension that was breeding a lot of this, is that when you have a multi-sided market, you're really dealing with a lot of different end users. Like, and how you balance those is going to influence the type of site you have and how users across are treated. And so what was happening with programmatic advertising on YouTube was that advertisers had, you know, limited control over where their ads were showing up. And so YouTube suddenly had an impetus to kind of manage all of their users on their platforms because they didn't want to make advertisers angry. And advertisers were getting angry. Their content was showing up in places that they didn't expect it to. And that's where, like, you know, you start seeing YouTube not look at these creators as a customer base per se, but really as a worker, because they're trying to ensure and solidify that revenue that's coming in from advertisers, because the advertisers are threatening to pull it, by creating kind of a more stable environment across the system. So yeah, again, it's been about kind of balancing these different these different stakeholder groups and who these platforms really see as their customer. In the end, the advertiser is their main customer.
You mentioned I know the concept from Martin Kenny's and his colleagues' work, the entrepreneur dependent, the platform dependent entrepreneur, sorry, that way. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to content creators on platforms like YouTube, I think one, let's say, measure that often comes up is the lock-in effect, and then reducing lock-in effect would lead to a bit more agency of the content creator. What I just thought about when you were talking, I was thinking about what type of like YouTube competitors are there or were there? And I think during the time there were quite some. I think Vimeo was trying to compete, and there was Twitch. They all has a bit like a different focus, but in terms of the character of the content that you produce, I would say quite similar. What I think is interesting, I would assume the multi-homing these content creators did have been doing is probably quite limited. I don't know. This is an assumption on platforms that have very, very similar content and also then very similar users, which is, in my opinion, counterintuitive a bit. What's also counterintuitive, in my opinion, is that only the moment a platform with an explicitly different need of content grows, this is when the creators actually shift and start multi-home. For example, someone active on and successful on YouTube now becomes active and successful on TikTok, while that actor has at a lot of more effort because the content is so different in my understanding, while maybe the same person was not multi-homing on Twitch and Vimeo, although it would probably be more like copy-paste. Can you help me solve the puzzle?
So I can't speak about it specifically within the context of Vimeo, because I don't think there would be, I didn't look at the rules at that time, basically. In terms of the fight between TikTok, Reels, and Shorts, they are preempting some of that. So within a lot of the monetization guidelines on all of the platforms, they include prohibitions against taking content that was from another platform and putting it on.
Okay. So
sometimes they use the language of watermarking because TikTok has that watermark. It's really Reels and Shorts that are trying to do that. What you are seeing, though, because it's happening regardless across those platforms, as they're still all kind of vying for that TikTok market, though it's happening a lot less than it was last year, is that you're starting to see, at least on TikTok especially, the development of what I have referred to just in a conference presentation, I haven't written this up at all, as like the monetization superstore. So whereas on YouTube, you know, you would have certain, and YouTube did try to do this as well. You would be able to get revenue from ad sharing. You'd also be able to kind of sell content on the site, but you might go to Patreon for doing a subscription. You'll still be dealing with like advertisers through whatever management company that you're doing. TikTok is an interesting model because they're trying to house all of that on one site, which is producing like a little bit of a lock-in effect. So, you know, you get advertisers through that site, although it's very difficult to do ad revenue sharing on TikTok just because the model is much different and they're only really offering it to the top creators. But they also have like ad marketplaces contained within TikTok. So you can brands match up with creators on the site. They now have the TikTok shop. They have subscription through TikTok. They have TikTok Live, TikTok Gifts. So they're kind of trying to contain it all within one platform. My guess is to stop people from having like this kind of diversity of revenue sources, which makes them a little bit more flexible in terms of the platforms that they're on. Because you can take, if you're on YouTube, that Patreon is going to be there no matter what. That Substack or whatever is going to be there no matter what. But if you're containing everything on one platform, that makes it much more difficult. Twitter is doing the same thing. They're trying to kind of lock in creators into basically like this infrastructure where you can have your paid newsletter on there. You can have your live stream on there and everything is contained within, which again, makes you a lot less flexible as you try and move across.
Wow. Yes, a lot, and that's interesting.
I did it for Thomas Pohl and David Nyborg. We all did a panel last year for AIR, and I put this together where I was looking at all of the monetization mechanisms across TikTok and Reels and YouTube, but I haven't done anything with it. But that also, like, that fight introduces some new in interesting elements to network effects, which I think are pretty worthy of study. So like YouTube Shorts, TikTok, you know, out of the gate has an advantage because they have all of these users that are already locked into the platform. The way that YouTube and Reels were trying to counteract that was that, so YouTube Shorts were allowing creators to take their existing videos and make them into Shorts. So you had like all of this existing content that then you could mine for additional content that would then go on different parts of the site. The way that Reels was trying to counteract that was through like kind of a similar thing. They were, I remember at the time as well, they were like even offering to you that if you wanted to make your stories into Reels, they would kind of do it for you. So like they were trying to introduce these other ways of looking and looking at the existing value on the site to kind of lock people in interesting ways. It's ripe for more analysis, basically. I don't have time right now, but yeah, at some point I'll do it.
But I would say that this can lead us to our usual question, that is, what's coming next? So what are you actually working into? What are the analyses you're looking at? Or what can be interesting in your opinion to study in the months to come?
So I have been working, I'm like not working very hard on it right now because I'm trying to adjust to being a real academic and teaching classes. But for the last long while, I've been working on a history of the verified badge. I worked on this, started working on this back in 2021. I think I started this in 2020. I got a grant in 2021 from Internet Society Foundations just to look at how this badge came to be, what were the problems it was being designed to solve, how did that change over time, why did this little blue check that is actually Twitter branding end up being the standard across all platforms, why did everybody go for this Twitter branded blue check? And then the kind of initial plan for the project was to look at, you know, how this little symbol was serving different needs simultaneously. So I was trying to take this work that I've done in the past, looking at all these different stakeholders involved in the setting of content standards. And I was trying to, but I've done it kind of at separate moments of time. So I didn't have this like nice little neat box to have everybody pivot around. And I've been trying to do that within the context of the verified badge. So what purpose did it serve for platforms? What purpose did it serve for journalists? What purpose did it serve for civil society organizations? What purpose did it serve for advertisers, et cetera? Now, recent developments have made that work much more difficult because when I started this, this was like just a little piece of infrastructure that was humming along in the background that everybody had kind of forgotten about as important, that everyone was just seeing as like a meaningless status symbol, but was actually serving some really interesting functions behind the scene. And it hadn't really changed for a while. And then it threw everything up in the air. And now it's a moving target. So I'm having to kind of grapple with how to, again, study another moving target. I thought I wasn't doing that for the first time ever. But it turns out I am. And that's my most recent stuff.
That's extremely interesting. Also, I read some, I mean, for sure you probably read this too. All these stories when X introduced this paid blue check mark, and then I don't know, some people named themselves Coca-Cola and announced.
That all happened after AIR last, the Association of Internet Researchers, the yearly conference. After AIR last year in Ireland, that started happening while I was first presenting all of my work on verification, which was very interesting. But then I got COVID at AIR and I end up back in the States and my husband suddenly had to do all the childcare because he didn't want to get COVID, obviously. And so I was just sitting there on my computer, like just screenshotting everything. We still just like do research on the fly. So COVID had a nice research silver lining for me last year.
I see. Robin, we reached the end of our conversation for today. We talked so much about social media. And before we close, we always ask, how can people follow you or learn about upcoming work and maybe get in touch? So is it that you're active on every platform or that you take something like a distant observer position? Tell me.
I am on every platform. I study social media because I love social media. So I'm on Twitter at Robin Kaplan. I guess we have to call it X now. I'm on Mastodon, which I'm trying to use a lot more. Robin Kaplan there as well. And I'm on Blue Sky as Robin Kaplan there too. I'm on TikTok, but I don't post anything. That's anyway.
Very good. We will link your profiles in the show notes, then people can follow and find you. Yeah, thank you so much, Robin, for joining us. It was a lively, very interesting conversation. I enjoyed it very much, and look forward to your upcoming findings about the infamous blue check mark and anything else that's to come.
Okay, thank you guys. This was lovely.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms.
You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.